Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in the Standard, 4-star review in the Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome man who's doing 4 rehearsals in 2 days. 4 weeks. It's Richard Herring. Thank you, rap fans. Hello, my fine friends. Welcome to another episode of Rich Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast. But I was hanging around with the Why Don't You gang for the Bristol. The Bristol Why Don't You gang. Like, I knew that would. I mean, like, there's people with white hair who don't know what I'm talking about. Do you remember the Why Don't You gang? Why don't you just switch off your television set and go and do something less boring instead? Sitting at home, watch TV. Turn it off. For a long time, I just turned the TV off when that came on and thought I was quite clever. Then I watched it. It was quite good. Anyway, they call it Rehalistapa. They call it Wadiya. You might get next week's one. If you're here next week, you might remember. So, yeah, look, I was in Leicester. As do people at home will know, done a couple of weeks in Leicester yesterday, and that was fun. But it's nice to, you know, they're all king stealing pricks there, so it's good to be away. I put up with it. It's Richard of York, isn't it? It's the clue's in the name. Lots of things have been going on. I wanted to tell you about the water in Venice has disappeared as we go to press. And I think that's due to all the Veneziana pizzas I bought in Pizza Express. 25p. It's gone too far. It went too far. That's why they've had to stop doing that deal. The Veneziana pizza was good. Right, there was a discretionary 25p donation to the Venice in Peril Fund. You mean, I don't think they do it anymore. But on 2 occasions, I managed to turn that into a shag. And I'm pretty impressed. Pretty impressive. I don't know why I didn't do it more than twice. But I went on 2 dates and on at Pizza Express, because I'm classy. And I refused to pay the discretionary 25 pence on both occasions. The women I was with were so impressed. They had full sexual intercourse with me. Not in the restaurant. Wait till we got home. I went out with one of them for 18 months. So careful what you wish for. It was Julia Sawala. So be careful what you wish for. I don't think she had sex with me that night, actually. But there we go. so sorry about that. But that would, if and I'm not a dating man anymore. But that would be, if they bring it back, try that. You've got to be careful with it because you couldn't just come across looking like an arsehole. You've got to do it. Going, I don't, you know, it's discretionary. I was just being pedantic about it being discretionary, and I did say I hated Venice and wanted it to sink into the sea. I think both the women realised I was doing a bit. I think don't think they liked me because I hated Venice. I've got like this new story as well, which I covered on Twitch of Fun a few weeks ago. It'll be now by the time this goes out. Do listen to Twitch of Fun and watch Twitch of Fun. It's a fantastic... It's probably the world's best topical show with a man and 131-year-old ventriloquist dummy. It's on twitch.tv. That's where all the big kids are now. A flying instructor died in flight after suffering a cardiac arrest. It gets funnier. It's not really a funny story, but his co-pilot thought he was fooling around. So prior to takeoff, the pair chatted normally while the pilot taxied the craft out to the runway. The pilot said the instructor's last words were, "Looks good, there is nothing behind you." Oh, the irony. Everything was behind him. Shortly after takeover, the instructor's head rolled back. As the two pilots knew each other well, the co-pilot thought his companion was just pretending to take a nap. When he completed the circuit, the report said, when the plane turned, the instructors slumped over so his head rested on the co-pilot's shoulder. But again, the pilot still thought a joke was being played on him. And so it was only when he landed that he realised the guy was dead. Which is quite a long time to do the joke, isn't it? It's a long joke, and I kind of wish the guy had just gone, yeah, no, he's always joking around. He isn't really dead, he's just pretending to turn up at the funeral. I know what's going on, he's going to pop out in a minute. I mean, I think, you know, if your friend goes down, just check their pulse, terrible thing. No, it's you're right, it wasn't funny. Let's crack on. Why don't you just switch up television set and go do something? Let's meet our guest. He is probably best known for having an honorary doctor of social science. He is an honorary doctor of social science from the University of Wolverhampton. That's why we're all here tonight. Talk to him about that, what he knows about social science. Will you please welcome the incredible Al Murray, ladies and gentlemen. Doctor of social science. Hello. You're an honorary doctor of social science.
I am, yeah.
And not just that, there was another one as well. You've got a couple of honorary degrees, haven't you?
I got another one from Luton.
Yeah. Pretty good.
I can't remember what in. It was a good lunch, though. It was a nice lunch.
Okay. Did they give you a certificate?
There is a certificate, but I've lost it. So I have got two. Thanks for reminding me about the other one. The one at Wolverhampton was really good.
Yeah.
Because history is a social science now.
Oh, okay.
It's been like sort of... told it's not history anymore. It's been like digested,
yes,
by social science. And yeah, there was a very nice guy at Wolverhampton who basically wanted to have lunch with me. So that's how that happened. But you have to dress up in all the kit. So you have to borrow the kit. You have to wear the mortarboard.
You have to do a speech to the
youngsters.
I did
do a speech that went for fuck all because basically it was, they're all, you know, young people, and at Wolverhampton, it's mainly sciences. So I come on and go, hey, don't do as you're told and all that. And
oh, really?
Went for nothing. And yeah. And at Luton, the guy said, the great thing about the UCD University is it's really near the airport. So we're good. So we do very well with foreign students. And he said, what will happen when this ends is they're all going to fly back to the Middle East to basically get on their planes and...
Sort of lazy foreign students who go, I want to go to the university nearest. I was in Luton.
Yeah, but if you're in Luton,
yeah,
you really want to need... Well, it is near the airport.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a chicken and egg, that one. But, yeah. I mean, if you're going to go to Luton... Anyway, the point is...
You'll want to go.
You want to leave. Yeah.
Weirdly, at the first time in my life, I got lost in Luton last night on my way back from Leicester.
Really?
And I ended up in Luton Airport. I don't know how I did it. I took a wrong turning and I thought, fuck, I'm going to have to pay £6 for the drop-off fee. Well, but I managed to find a way around without
doing
it.
That's because you're doing four of these in 2 days and your body's telling you to go on holiday.
It's pretty bad when you're going, where am I? What's going on? I don't recognise
anything. Luton Airport!
I'm at Luton Airport. It was, it's a terrible place, Luton.
You know, and Russell T. Davis was a presenter on Why Don't You?
I didn't know that. I think Gideon from Six Music was,
yeah,
wasn't he?
Gideon Coe,
Gideon
yeah.
Gideon Coe, yeah.
Yeah, but that was...
Russell T. Davis's
first gig was presenting.
Which...
But on late, Why Don't You.
Oh, really?
Late. So basically the equivalent of, like, Sylvester McCoy, Why Don't You.
Yeah, I thought you meant, like, Why Don't You After Dark.
That's a different programme.
The kids showed you how to...
Should pitch that. That's an amazing idea.
Had a finger. That's what we call it. That would get some people, kids watching TV.
That would get made.
So good. Yeah, and I don't remember Russell T. Davis on it. Would you have liked to have been in the Why Don't You gang?
No.
Did you watch it?
They were like crazy. They were wild people. And I was very square when I was a boy. Never.
There was a boy at our school who ended up being like doing stuff on BBC. In BBC Bristol did a lot of the nature programs, and there was a boy in our school who ended up being like the kid that got onto those nature programs, and I was really jealous. I didn't like nature, but I thought, how did he get?
Maybe he was faking it too.
Maybe
a show business.
Yeah, where is he now, though?
That's the big question.
Yeah, look, I'm here.
Yeah, what's his name?
I can't remember. That's terrible, isn't it?
Chris Packham.
It was David Attenborough. He hasn't aged well. Very good. Well, look, let's talk about what we're talking about backstage, which is very exciting, which is the Spitting Image live show that you've co-written.
Yes, co-written.
Been involved in beyond, you seem to be going to it and stuff, so you're a producer as well or something like that?
No, I'm like all these things, I'm cut into a mythical back end if we get into the West End, and if we're there for a long time, and at some point it'll tip, and we'll suddenly all be rich, which is how they entice you into doing things in the theatre. But it's basically myself, Matt Ford, and Sean Foley, who did the play What I Wrote.
Yeah, amazing.
Who's an amazing, brilliant, brilliant comedy director, and who just did Upstart Crow with David Mitchell, which they'd done for 3 weeks before the pandemic, and then. Had to put it on hold, and then they revived it in the autumn last year. And the three of us have written this thing. I mean, we've written three and a half things.
Yes.
Because we got kind of caught outflanked by events at one point. Although, I mean, the more I think about it, we started writing it in March last year. We'd have had to rewrite the ending five times in the intervening anyway.
Yeah.
And we'd have had to change who the lead character was, but we'd have had to change the thrust of it as we went. And
so you based around Boris Johnson.
The first show was called The Liar King.
Yes.
And and it was the story of Boris Johnson, you know, how he becomes world king, because he said he wanted to when he was a kid.
Right.
According to his sister, you know, he declared when he was five, I shall become world king. So the plot was basically, and obviously quite a lot changed since we wrote this, but the original plot was Boris realises time's up, so goes to see the Queen, throws her down a well, having... because there's a wishing well in Buckingham Palace, magical wishing well in Buckingham Palace. Having got her to sign the bottom of a piece of paper, and which of course said, you know, he says, before I go, an autograph, please.
Yes.
And it says, I appoint Boris world king, right? Throws it down a well, becomes world king. While he's on his way there, because we're going to have two Boris puppets, so there was going to be him in a black suit and then another one in a white suit, who was his conscience, who he'd given the slip when he was four, right? And we're going to have a scenario with these two little boy Borises having a fight with... Naughty Boris wedgying the other one. And we had this whole thing, and it ended with Boris kills Peppa Pig by accident. And so, because the thing is about this, you can have anyone you want in it.
Yes,
just make a puppet, right? And any resemblance to persons living or dead is the point. And it ended with basically him in the tower waiting to go to the gallows, and his conscience turns up, and Boris tricks his conscience into going to the gallows for him. And he's world king at the end, and then the Queen came back from the dead, although...
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's quite a different story now. Though we've retained elements of that, because the puppet of him is amazing, and Matt's impression of him is so, so good. And also, he's still, you know, literally lurking in the background in politics at the moment. We couldn't leave him out. So he's still in it, but it's a radically different story.
Yeah, so you've gone for more like a celebrity...
It's a Marvel film. It's a Marvel film. It's Idiots Assemble.
Yeah.
Vladimir Putin says, I see what it is now. It's a shit Marvel film, Idiots Assemble, at one point. Because basically what we've done is we have a fake Pross Arch built in, so like in a traditional theatre, with boxes either side. So Harry and Meghan are watching in a box that side, and Putin and Xi are watching in a box that side. And they end up getting involved, obviously. But the story is, it starts on the morning of King Charles's coronation. He's meeting with his most trusted advisor, who's Paddington Bear, who is actually called Jesus Fernando Compostela. And there's cocaine in the marmalade sandwiches. Because you just make this really horrible, disgusting Paddington puppet, then you can have him say what you want, right? It's the freedom of it. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
So you can put words into Harry's mouth. You could put words into Meghan's mouth, into the king's mouth. You know, it's a really interesting toy box.
Yeah.
But the plot is, so basically the fabric of society is wearing thin, and there's a piece of fabric that the royal family have to look after. Who can possibly help us with this impossible mission? And then this Tom Cruise puppet, of course, falls down in red lights from the... You know, and then we go from there, and he assembles a posse of heroes. They have to fight the world's most evil men and James Corden. And these are the beats of the story, and they're deported to Rwanda, and there's a sort of Suella Braverman that's like an exorcist doll creature, who's possessed by the idea of deporting people. So, but we were. What is really amazing about it is we're really trying to engage with the energy of the old program. It's a long time ago now, and it first aired 39 years ago this week. So it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I understand why people don't know what it is anymore. I get it. Yeah. So we've got an opportunity to kind of refresh it. We're not doing... It's not like the telly, because there's no rinse, repeat. There's no... You can compare it to the TV programme if you want, but you won't get very far with that, because it's a theatrical piece. So it's a two-act play with musical numbers and a big finish and all that. And it's... But we're also trying to do... It's supposed to be like an 18th century cartoon pamphlet, grotesque.
Yes, okay.
You know, with the freedom they had to write really, really rude things about the powers that be that you see in 18th century pamphleteering. That Roger Law, who created Spitting Image, was very much in the... He was self-consciously in that tradition.
Yeah.
And so we've really tried to do that. And one of the things we've definitely done... So I don't know if people know... So the Threepenny Opera, which is a Bertolt Brecht, Kurt Weill musical from the 30s I think it's from the 50s, but it's about Berlin, interwar Berlin, which was based on the Beggar's Opera, which is John Gay's play from the time of William Hogarth, which is about magistrates and thief takers in London and how the politicians are cheat by jowl with the crooks, and the crooks are in with what fills in for the police. And in that play, they have all these people with names, so you know who they all are if you know what's going on in London.
Yeah,
and then they take popular songs of the time and they change the words, and he turns it into this sort of folk tale, and at the end the audience decide what happens. So we've kind of drawn on a bit of that kind of Georgian satirical tradition as well, because that's where on stage and in pamphlets people started being really, really openly rude about the powers that be, and we want to tap into that. We want to be part of that feeling.
Yes.
And so the show's got that in it. So if you want to see the royal family singing Bohemian Rhapsody about Prince Andrew's peccadilloes, then buy a ticket.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, it's...
I know it sounds all pretentious, but that is what we're really trying to tap into.
Sure, but no, it is extraordinary to go back. I mean, I suppose the original TV show felt like that, didn't it? It felt like this is... sort of groundbreaking, this is much ruder than we're used to. People, at that point, people hadn't, you know, putting the voice of the Queen Mother and doing her as whatever they did her as a was it a Cockney or Northern? I can't remember what it was.
Yeah,
they
she was a Cockney. Yeah,
Cockney. Then it was, you know, people were shocked and offended.
I know, it is amazing.
Yeah,
that they were. I mean, it's like all these things when you look at Elvis and people go, he's going to destroy Western civilization, and it's a bloke going, oh, you know, like, it's, yeah. And then punk rock, oh my God, you know, like it's so shocking, right? The idea that the and of course the satire boom in the early 60s,
yeah,
you know, no one had, I mean, apparently no one had ever done an impression of a prime minister before on television, you know, Peter yeah. Cook's impression of Harold Macmillan, like. Scared the horses. It is interesting when you look at those moments where supposedly things are massively shocking. But we've tried to... You want that energy, and you could do it in a theatre.
Yeah, well, there's the freedom still of live performance, regardless of what comedians say about everything. You can't do anything anymore. You can still, within the theatre.
You could do an awful lot of things that you couldn't do 30 years ago.
Sure.
Even 20 years ago. Taboos have never, ever not been shifting.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. I mean,
you'll find your way through.
Yeah, and we do have a we have. I mean, the fact that Tom Cruise is our lead in the story means we've got to do all sorts of things about him. And you know, we haven't been sued yet.
So it might be good.
There's plenty of time for that. Yeah.
Do you think it would be cheating on your partner if you had sex with the spitting image puppet?
No.
Have you considered renting out the Suala Braverman puppet on an hour by hour basis?
Now you bring it up.
It might be a way of covering some of your costs.
Well, I mean...
I mean, they're life-size, right, as well?
Some of them are. She's one of the smaller ones.
I can make it work.
The Carrie Johnson puppet has... Stalking breasts
really?
As well. I mean,
okay, that might
you should have her on the show.
I read somewhere about the show notes you're getting are kind of quite surreal.
Oh, God. I'll read you the show notes. The show notes are amazing. So basically, the show report you get after every performance, you get a show report that basically, you know, sums up how tonight went. Where are they? From Jasmine. And tonight's show report, Saturday 20th. This is Saturday's show report.
Right, and it...
It contains, you know, performance number 27, audience, house count, 597. And then you get who's in attendance, who did what, technical notes. So-and-so watched tonight's show. Technical note two, the exploding cabinet pyro Q1 misfired. The cabinet collapsed as desired. Right, we've had a recurring problem with that. Maintenance, right? So this is the one. Today's notes as follows. Puppets, mild lesions on Rishi's neck. Boris's teeth are coming loose. Fixed by B. O'Shea, who's one of the puppeteers doing the show. Maggie's wig is slipping. Can Keir's Superman stuffy be looked at? Puppet maintenance tracker available here, and there's a link for the puppet maintenance. This is basically, and then you get you know, a captivated audience with raucous responses throughout, with many standing at the curtain call, which is, you know, what you're after. But the first night, the opening night, we've got a bit where where our heroes are in a boat because they've been deported and they've escaped, and they're coming back across the channel, and Nigel Farage pisses on them from the White Cliffs of Dover. Right. And it said on the first night, Nigel, I'll find it for you because it's really, really funny. Here are tonight's show notes. Thank you, Jasmine. Right, so here we go. As the pub was tracking upstage, the spade disconnected. Okay, fine. Fly Q8 was slowed down. Delay to Act 2 when we confirmed the wardrobe set was complete. Note 6. So, note 5, the fish head dropped off the body as it entered today, retrieved by Bertie Hans during the Stand Tall Little Man. Note 6, there was a touch too much water from the urinating Farage on stage, causing a few slips during Stand Tall Little Man, which is a song, Stormzy sings to to Tom Cruise in the And then the opening night, hole in Queen's chin. Ian is missing a thimble and top thimble is coming loose. So Ian McKellen's our narrator. Suella head is coming loose from body. Split in Megan 2's nose. Rishi top thimble loose. King Charles dowel holder needs reattaching. So I mean, that's the opening night. They all fell apart the opening night. And there's been this amazing effort to run the repairs on them. But the show notes are... You get these extraordinary messages. Hole in Queen's chin on show two. I mean, and on it goes.
I mean, it makes the show sound pretty spectacular. People, you know, there's...
There's a cast of 106 puppets in it, right?
How many puppeteers?
12. And you do get the odd thing where it goes, you know, ice pack needed for so-and-so at the end of that scene. Because,
yeah.
the you know, they're big and they're quite... The ones that have come off the TV show are heavier than the ones... They made some new ones for the stage.
Yeah.
But they're quite heavy, and so they kind of get 5 minutes out of a puppeteer. It's quite demanding. Yes. as a piece of theatre. But, I've seen it, I think, a half dozen times now, and it's amazing. And what's also going on is more and more detail goes in as the puppeteers... like get more into it and are finding extra little bits of business. We've got the thing, there's a thing called the Circle of Jerks, which is when the Tory party all come in, like in the style of the Lion King. So we've got this 12-foot tall Rhys Moggs praying mantis, and Priti Patel's a bat, and what's her name? Therese Coffey's a slug with a cigar, and the smoke comes out of her ass as well. It's really funny. But basically we've got all that and the business, I've seen, you know, each time I go back, you said there's more business built into that. If you've got all the puppeteers on stage together, working the business together, it's like it's a cartoon and someone's filled in all the detail.
Yeah.
It's really amazing.
So you're kind of hoping nothing really happens in the world.
Well,
nothing changes. If the Tory government fell tomorrow...
I mean, well, that's all right.
Yeah.
It would
be more than all right, but yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously, we'd really love to bring the government down, but just not yet. We want it to go into the West End for at least 18 months and then bring the government down. But no, if the government comes down next week, do they mind? To rewrite it. But no, so we had to deal with Sturgeon about Sturgeon's retirement or resignation 10 days ago. And that was, I was on holiday. I was in Tenerife. But, you know, WhatsApp...
Yes.
Is the great leveller, and it pops up immediately. What are we going to do? So everyone's pitching lines on the group, and then Jess Robinson does Sturgeon. She was on a holiday in the Lake District, so she drove down from the lakes to Birmingham with her mum and a dog in the car, did the new lines, they rehearsed it with the puppeteer, stuck it in, and that evening, there it was, her going, that's it, I resign, on top of the lines we had her doing anyway.
Yeah. So the whole, all the words are
pre-recorded. It's all a track, yeah, yeah. Because otherwise... which is how they used to make the programme. So they'd record it and then the puppeteers would do it to the track. Because there's just, you couldn't, where would you put them in the orchestra pit? How would it work? And also, you'd then be paying for impressionists night and day. And that would be really expensive. And, you know, our mysterious, back end would disappear even further into the future. So it's to a track. But you can get someone to record lines on a phone now. I mean, that's the other thing is the technology has levelled a big part of that kind of playing field. So if you need an insert, I can do. I got a home studio, and I'm doing some of the voices, and 4D has as well. And in fact, anyone who does voiceover basically has stuff at home now since the pandemic. So you know, actually running repairs are quite easy to do. I mean, our big problem would be if Sunak quit tomorrow, and then a Tory came in who we don't have a puppet of.
Right.
They take about 4 weeks to turn around.
Okay.
Because it's, you get a caricaturist in, you pick the caricature you like the best, they're then sculpted, they're turned into there's a mould, it has to dry, the puppet has to dry, then they have to be painted. They have to, you know, and it's a sort of four-week process. So we'd probably, because we've got a scene where it's said, you know, this is where the big beasts of the Tory party gather to choose a leader every few weeks, right? So we'd probably have someone with a paper bag with a smiley face to come on and go, hello, it's me, you know, whoever. If it's not Rob, I mean, anyway, it's something we're not going to worry about. No, it's going to drive us mad.
It's interesting. I mean, it's sort of interesting you had to write it three or four times, even in the first place.
But devising a thing that is kind of... the royal family, fortunately, have a thing in place for when one of them dies, which is that they're replaced by their... So when the Queen died, we were able to put Charles in her place. That was fortunately no biggie. But But it's yeah.
Al
we
Murray
tried...
claims the Queen's death was no biggie.
I mean, the
that's
amazing
the take-home
thing
headline,
about
Daily
amazing...
Mail.
Yeah, but come on. Everyone, it was going to happen at some point, and no one seemed prepared for it. It was amazing. I was in a theatre that night, and they went shit that afternoon when it was obviously what happened. And she's in the theatre. They go, shit, what do we do? We haven't got a protocol. I think she's. How long has this been? I mean, not, how long is the death of the Queen been coming? But it was a weird moment, anyway.
Yeah.
But we've kind of, I think what we've done is we've kind of built a thing that you know, it's like a vessel and you could change the sails, but not have to change the whole thing. No. That's the idea.
Sure.
But it might not work out like that.
It sounds amazing. It reminds me a bit of the Oxford Review 1989.
Yeah. Worst show on the fringe.
It was 88 or 89?
89.
Yeah. Because that was a big concept show about the world ending.
The world ending, yeah.
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 The worst show.
Worst show on the fringe, according to The Independent, The Observer.
Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, you know who directed that?
I can't remember.
No, I can't remember who he
can't
was.
I can't remember who he was. Yeah. it wasn't me. It was the other one.
No, you had you had nothing to do with that show, did you?
No.
Yeah. No. You'd been burned the year before.
I'd had a terrible, terrible
God,
time.
So awful. I remember watching that thinking, this is a bit mean. Anyway.
There we go. What a one. I'm still dealing with it. I'm still trying to get through it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, look, I was reminded, I don't think we talked about this before. This is your, including Edinburgh and the book club, the thing we did for Fame, which went up in the book club. This is your seventh appearance.
Is it?
Yeah.
I thought it was kind of my fifth or fourth.
Like three in Edinburgh, I think, in the original run. Did that 3 year run in Edinburgh. And then we did, talked about your last book on, put that as one of the early book clubs. But it's 5 years since you've last been
here
doing this one.
You see, but that I thought it was 3 years ago, but that's pandemic time.
It was 2018, about this time, 2018. Yeah, yeah. Five years, which seems insane. And that was the only Rahulastapur, thank you, that didn't stay for the whole.
Yeah, you buggered off. I told some boring anecdote.
I think you went on for a long time. I don't think we put it out, actually. But
fine.
But I didn't stay to the end. That's the only time that's happened. So
let's see if we can.
We'll see what happens.
See if we can top that.
Next half an hour or 3 hours, depending how long this goes on. But you had your own chat show, and you had amazing guests as the pub landlord.
Yeah,
I was watching something today. I mean, you had I just happened across the one which was you had Philip Schofield.
I know.
With Cilla Black and Des O'Connor.
I know.
As all three of them together. It was pretty
it's
impressive.
The ITV Elephant's Graveyard.
I'm not saying everyone who comes into contact with you dies, Albert.
Well, eventually they
shall. But it was quite funny because I remember Cilla Black was sort of.
She was very grand.
She was very grand, but then there were some rude jokes and she couldn't believe it. And then she was talking about Des O'Connor being in the hotel where Des O'Connor had conceived his last child.
Yeah.
And made it sound like she was in the room. But yeah, she was sort of shocked but enjoying it. Mm. But what were your favourite people? Because you must have done a lot.
Well, we had Buzz Aldrin on.
Yeah, wow.
He was amazing. And I remember doing the warm-up, and it was this thing. I would do the warm-up for the show, so to keep the whole thing sort of on tone, but or a lot of it, and then Gordon Southern used to fill in the rest, who's brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant. And but we had Buzz Aldrin on, so I came on and said, we've got a real treat for you tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We got Buzz, and Buzz Aldrin didn't know what on earth he'd walked into. Right, because you pay Buzz Aldrin.
Yeah.
Right, that's how it works. If you want to meet the second man on the moon, you give him money.
Right.
It's as simple as that. Right, he was in town for something else, so we gave him some money and he came on the show.
Yeah.
And you could see him like thinking, what the hell is going on here? What is this? So I go on and went, we've got a very special guest for you, Buzz Aldrin. And he only went to the fucking moon and the place went wild, right? and apparently in the green room he goes, I think I'm going to be okay with this show. Because he doesn't know if people are going to say to him, or yeah. He didn't, I mean, it's a long time ago this now, did you even go, mate, right? But what was really funny, one of my daughters are here tonight, my elder daughters, Scarlett and Willow. And Scarlett used to come to those recordings fairly regularly. And Buzz's wife... And Buzz has just remarried, and that's fantastic news and everything, because he's 89 or something, and yes. hope for everybody and all that. And I hope he doesn't ruin it by having a couple of children and for himself. And his wife at the time had an awful lot of plastic surgery, right? Like a tremendous amount of plastic surgery, right? And I remember Scarlett saying to me, Dad, and she must have been 6 or 7 at the time, or maybe eight, and she said, Dad... I look at Buzz's wife and she makes me think of space. So he was great. but that was amazing meeting him.
Yeah,
that was truly incredible to meet him.
Yeah.
And we did all these stupid jokes. Like we had a thing with like a drink on a piece of string, like it was zero gravity. And you could see him thinking, what the fuck is this? Who is this idiot? Right. Which is exactly what we were kind of going for.
Sure.
Like, who is this idiot? Like, because we... And then Donny Osmond was on the show, who was brilliant. And I'd walk over hot coals for Donny Osmond. He was a fantastic bloke. Because I'd met him a couple of times before... And he was always like, Al Murray, what are you doing? How's it going? I hear everything's great for you. Like, it's like, you don't have to do that, right? You don't have to be like that, Donnie. It's fine, right? And we had this whole joke about how he was a merman, not a Mormon. And I deliberately spilled water on him to see if he'd sprout fidget. And he's going, ah. It's such a sweet man. And we did this thing where we had this, the pub landlord, because we had Gary on Time Gentleman Please.
Yeah.
Who was the dog in the sitcom. And then we, for the talk show, I had a stuffed dog called Ramrod. It was this black, really scruffy dog that had been sketched on a whiteboard, and the prop guy went away and came back with this dog on a trolley. Exactly from a thing drawn on a whiteboard. Like, yeah. But black as well. So the director's going, why is it black, you fucking idiots? I can't film that. But the really great thing about it is when you press the button on the lead, his eyes lit up red. Right? And so the whole thing, he was invented to say to Donny Osmond, look, I used to have a dog called Ramrod, and when I sung Puppy Love to him, his eyes would light up. Right? But he's dead, right? But fortunately, I stuffed him and myself... You know, that was a long weekend, all this sort of stuff. And then I go and get him, plug him on the thing, and said, could you sing Puppy Love to my dead stuffed dog? It's so funny, this. And he did. He got down on one knee, and they called it Puppy Love. And obviously, halfway through, I pressed the button, his eyes light up. I mean, we entertained ourselves mainly on that show. And ITV didn't feel that way about it. But it was really, really... It was an amazing, amazing thing to... Amazing thing to have done.
Have you put all of it? Because you've got your own YouTube channel. I know you've put Time Gentleman Please up there. I think some of it's been up.
We inevitably ran it... We had this running joke as well that whatever the band were that we had on, they'd play their new one and I'd go, well, that was all right, but you're not as good as Queen. Come back at the end with a Queen cover.
Yeah.
And we had them in a set that was meant to look like a pub toilet. And so they would. So Madness did a version of Killer Queen, and the Wombats did. Brian Ferry did Fat Bottom Girls, and not Brian Ferry. You know what's his name? The Canadian singer.
Brian Adams.
Brian Adams did Fat Bottom Girls.
I'd love to see
right?
Brian Ferry doing Fat Bottom Girls.
Well, so would have I. So would I. Well, that was the idea. Is that we? And what was really so we've run in. I think for YouTube and all that, we've kind of run into like one of those really annoying problems, because it was a really because the thing is when we put the programs, they're going, they're saying, oh, if you have a band on and they do their new one at the end, people will turn over, because it's always that thing, they do a song and they run the credits. Yeah. So they'll turn over. So I said, well, the way to do it then is we do their song halfway through when there's still some program left, but with the offer of, what if at the end of the show, you know, Backstreet Boys do Bohemian Rhapsody?
Yeah.
And that's what we did. And then in the end, Queen got word of it. So they came on the end of the first series. So I got to sing with Queen at the end of the first series, which is totally mental. And I was going through a rough time. I was getting divorced at the time. Things were going wrong at home. And it was a really rough time. And I remember sitting there like thinking, oh, I don't know what... Oh, fuck me, I've got to... This is all like doing my head in, the pressure of it all, and also going home is really difficult. And one of the crew sat down next to me and said, I bet this is your wildest dream to sing with Queen. And I said, no, of course not. And no one dreams they'll ever sing with Queen. It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Fucking ridiculous. And then we had them back. And then at the end of the second series, we had them on again. And they had Paul Rogers from Free singing with them. So they used to do All Right Now.
Yeah.
And... we went to a break. They did their new one that they'd done with him. And we came out of the break and we came out of the break with him finishing Bohemian Rhapsody. And I said, oh, you won't believe what's happened during the adverts, ladies and gentlemen. Queen just played Bohemian Rhapsody. By the way, I'm a bit sick of Queen now. Right? Said it to Queen's face. Bit sick of Queen now. Do you know any Free? Right? And so they did All Right Now at the end of the programme. We had so much fun with that. It was an amazing thing to have done.
Yeah. No, it was good. Well, look, there is some of it online, so go and have a look. It is funny, and I suppose it's very hard interviewing a character, but it does seem to work the other way around, where a character does the interview. So that's obviously Mrs. Merton was a fine example.
I mean, and Dame Edna, when we put it together, we pitched it as Pub Landlord, Dame Edna Experience.
Yeah, right.
And I'll be rude to people's faces and they might not know. I remember the first two or three, the guests, you could see them going, what the fuck is going on? Because you do the standard research chat,
yeah,
where the researcher would ring up and go, and, you know, it says here you really like pottery. And the star would go, yeah, I like a bit of pottery. And then they'd expect to be asked about it. And then we would write these interviews that were like basically 30 jokes I'm going to fire at them, 30... You know, and then if they go for that, we'll follow it up with this and follow up questions, like a sort of political interview, really, rather than but all of it jokes. And I remember Jason, the look on Jason Donovan's face during the first episode, like, what the fucking hell have I let myself in for? But he was a sport in the end, and it came down to that thing as well. If people like joined in and had fun with it, they looked great, you know, rather than sort of if their hackles went up. It only happened a couple of times.
Did you have anyone who... I've had people who've not let me put episodes out.
No, we didn't have him on. Louis Walsh... He'd obviously... He'd not... you know, they must have all been sent clips. He'd obviously not watched it. And he kept correcting me. Because we used to have a thing where I'd make deliberate mistakes. Right? Like I'd half read the notes.
Yeah.
And it was not long after Little Britain time, or around Little Britain time, and I kept calling them Dave Lucas and Matt Williams.
Right. Right?
And he would correct me. It's like, no, I'm getting it wrong on purpose, mate. I'm getting it wrong on purpose, for fuck's sake. But in general, I mean, people were, it was really good fun to do, and there was something really amazing about. You'd have people on who've been like really PR trained,
yeah.
And if you didn't play ball with them, they wouldn't know what to do. Sure. And that was quite good fun.
Yeah, no, it's well worth looking up. I do remember from the time, but it was nice to see it again. Let's talk about you. You're doing so many things. I mean, you're back on tour as well, but you've written a proper history book. So, yeah. Like, last time I talked to you about your funny, copy, your funny history book, which still has some history in it, and some very good history in it, which was called A Hunt. What was it called? A Hunt?
The 20th Century and All That.
Yeah, 20th Century and All That, which is great. But this is, like, no joke. Well, you know, some...
There's some lines in it.
There's some lines.
Yeah.
But it's about World War II, called Command, How the Allies Learned to Win the Second World War.
Yeah.
Which is, it's terrific. You get it as an audio book, which is what I always recommend, because you can listen to it as you drive your car around or run around the block. But when you read it yourself,
yep,
which is always good.
Cheaper.
So, tell us what you wanted to achieve with this and what the book is.
Well, basically, the book is 10 portraits of people, of officers on the British and American and Commonwealth side, I have this podcast with James Holland, who's a real Second World War author, and we coined an acronym, which is DUKE, Dominions UK Empire, which is who's fighting on the British side during the Second World War. So that includes New Zealand, Australia, Canada, South Africa, India, or the British Empire, basically. But, you know, with the qualifications of Dominion and all that. Anyway, so it's DUKE generals and a couple of American generals. The story of the Second World War, I think, is interesting, or one of the stories of the Second World War is interesting because the West, the Allies, get off to a really horrendous, appalling start.
Yeah.
The kind that you, when you look at it, could have just finished them off completely and somehow recover from the you know, the Dunkirk. My grandfather was killed in the fighting outside Dunkirk. I don't like when it's presented as a miracle. Mm. It's as big a disaster as any army, as any army has ever suffered in military history. It's only topped by Singapore, really. It's an absolute total calamity. And the reasons get sort of elided around, but it's pretty clear what went wrong and why. And yet the most amazing thing is 4 years later, you know, the Normandy invasion happens and the British are like the Duke forces are back with the Americans, and it's like they're a completely different setup.
Yes.
And that is amazing. That alone in the story of the Second World War is incredible. And there's, you know, all the things that make that happen. So what I wanted to do was use 10 people to tell 10 points in the history of the Second World War, and also talk about what being those people was like, what the decisions were they were having to face, and what the institutions they were wrestling with were like as well. So, I've got famous people in it, and then people who no one has ever heard of.
Yeah.
So I've got Monty in it and Patton, because you can't avoid them. But I've tried to write about them from a different angle to the way they're normally written about.
Sure.
And then people no one has ever heard of, like Peter White, Alastair Pearson, White is the last chapter in the book, and he was born in South Africa. He went to Surrey. He was an artist, son of an artist, a pacifist, a Christian, really not interested in the war at all. He was sort of, I think, 14 when it started. Right. So in 1939, you know, no realistic expectation, perhaps, that you'd have to do anything about it. And then by 1944, he has to join the army, he has to be an officer, and he ends up leading men. And he wrote an amazing biography, and he was also a brilliant artist, so the writing's really evocative. So he really tells you what the responsibility of being 19, 20 years old, having a platoon, sort of 30 guys, and trying to look after them, trying not to get them killed, trying to make sure they all keep it together, and you keep it together, because they need you to be together as a person. So he ends the book, but I start off with Monty, who, you know, is the most famous British general and much maligned, but I didn't write about the well-known bits of him. I wrote about before he was famous.
Yes.
You know, like an Angus Deaton clip show.
Well, it's, you know, I know you are super interested in war and the mechanics of war and the hardware of war, which I've never really fascinated before, but reading it and thinking about, just 10 examples, but you realise that how many times this must have gone over and over again, but how difficult and how much preparation was just even a simple a salt on a place,
oh, God,
you'd need to combine all the different types of force. They've all got to arrive at the same time. The equipment's got to arrive.
It's completely boggling. And if you're, you know, if you're a, so I start with Montgomery, who's a divisional commander at the start of the Second World War, and he's had this really terrible. He had a good First World War, if you can have such a thing, where he was injured at the right moment, so he could then go into being a staff officer and learn how everything worked. So he wasn't just killed, right? And he learns how everything works, and then between the wars, he's that boring bloke who just wants to talk about work. when they're in the mess, and everyone wants to play polo, and the British Army goes through this real thing after the First World War where they just want to go back to proper soldiering rather than fighting. And proper soldiering is a bit of polo, a bit of parading, maybe a bit of police work, like nothing serious like the First World War. And he gains this real reputation for being, basically a total professional, and no one's interested. And come the Second World War, he's a divisional commander, so he's in charge of, and that means he's in charge of kind of 15,000 people. It's not the top level, it's somewhere down the machine, but the division is like the biggest unit size, sort of self-sufficient unit size in the British Army at the time. And he's brilliant at it. He's absolutely brilliant at it. But he gets in trouble during the first phase of the Second World War. I'm sure you all know, the war breaks out in September 39, but then nothing, the British don't do anything until May 1940, until they're forced to by the Germans attacking France. And he's a divisional commander during the Phony War period, or the Boer War, or the Sitzkrieg, as it's known. And he really cares about his men. He's unusual. He really, really cares about his guys. Not because he cares about them, but because he wants them as efficient as possible as soldiers. Yeah. So if that means he's got to fake liking them or care about their health. He's been described by another writer as he's basically a psychopath. He's like, it's like, because he loves it. He loves fighting. He loves war. Yeah. But he's actually really, really good at looking after his guys. And he gets in the winter of 1939, he writes a memo, a divisional memo. So he writes to all his officers saying, right, we're in France, and he's been in France before, 20 years, 25 years previously with the First World War, and they have a massive problem in the First World War with what they called VD at the time, sexually transmitted infections, STIs, a massive problem, to the point where the First World War is characterised as the trench foot war. The British Army hospitalises 75,000 people with trench foot during the First World War. Sounds like a lot of people. It's an organisation with 3.5 million people in it. It's a lot of people, but they hospitalise. How many people do they hospitalise for VD during the First World War? It's 450,000. And the problem then goes home. Yeah. So guys go home having caught the clap, take it home to their wives, and take it home to the prostitutes at home. And so there's an epidemic in the UK as well, to the point where they're removing doctors from France, from Flanders, to go home to the UK to deal with the VD epidemic. Yeah. And it causes a moral panic. And it falls down the old lines. There's the people who say, we shouldn't talk about this at all because sex is naughty, yeah, right? And wrong and morally undermines us. And then the other people who say, we need to talk about this and we need to give out condoms and we need to do health checks if we're going to have any influence over the course of events.
Yeah.
And the lobby A also think that women should be held responsible for this problem.
Yes, of course.
Of course. And lobby B think that the men should be held responsible for it. Hmm. But the strangest people are on the different sides. So Emmeline Pankhurst is very much on the moral outrage side.
Right, really, yeah.
Right, which is really interesting. Right?
Yeah.
And then the sort of, you know, classist, eugenicist side of opinion in Britain at the time thinks that, you know, this is a sign of moral decrepitude in the working classes, and VD will sort things out for it. It's right. Really mad. So anyway, so come the Second World War, Monty's thinking, well, I don't want that happened again. So he writes to his men, and it's a funny memo. He writes this memo in sort of, and he's funny. He's got this very bone dry wit, but he basically says, I understand the men, and I know what they're like, and I understand what young men are like, particularly when they're facing the prospect of possible death. Mm-hmm. And if they want to take their pleasure with a young lady in a turnip field, then so be it. Right? Yeah, he actually uses that expression. He says, should they seek horizontal refreshment? Right? Right? this is what we need to do. And he tells the officers to find a brothel that's approved, to run health checks, to get the men to admit it, to, you know, all this sort of thing. Yeah. And that memo goes out, and the head chaplain of the British Expeditionary Force and the head Roman Catholic chaplain call for his head and try to get him fired because of this memo, because of the language in it.
Yeah.
Which I find absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Right?
Because they're just not serious. They're not serious about the war. They're not serious about what they've embarked on. They're more interested in their daft moral positions.
Yes.
In a war, which is, after all, an insane moral position.
Yes.
Right? So they're all... And if they'd fired him, he really was the best divisional commander, then becomes an army commander, then becomes the guy who runs D-Day. If they'd fired him, they'd have had to find someone else. And as I said, they're an organisation that doesn't like talent, isn't interested in professional people. Who would have done it? And that question's unanswerable.
Yeah.
And so I start there, and then we work our way through different things.
It is sort of, I mean, it makes you think both how awful it would have been to, you know, how lucky we've been to live in a time where, so far, up to now. I mean, I think you and
we're
I are
too
safe.
Old, mate.
You
right.
and I are safe from conscription, I think. Is the way you go back really talking about fitness to go, really, how fit you've got to be to fight a war.
A really slow uphill attack.
I'll be all right.
We can do downhill attack.
But also to, but also just like, you know, STIs being so, you know, treatable, but only in horrible ways. But like,
well, and also
like syphilis was.
But it's syphilis we're talking about as well. So it's, which in the 19th century is basically straight AIDS.
Yes.
And is the moral panic that grips the whole of the world in the 19th century about what syphilis is and how it relates to madness and how it relates to genius and how you catch it and then it disappears and it might resurface and asylums are full of people with syphilis in the 19th century.
Yeah.
So they all know, when they talk about VD, they're not talking about thrush. You know, they're talking about something really, really serious.
But also people, even in spite of that, people still went out and had sex with prostitutes. So, like, knowing that you could get this terrible, terrible disease.
Well,
and, you know, and I know our generation went through it as well, and, you know, with AIDS and so, you know, and HIV. So you can't stop people.
Well,
you won't stop people.
And it's also really hard to stop young men who could die next.
Of course, they're not worried about
being mad
when they're 80, when they're not thinking they're going to get...
And the army's other big problem was VD was regarded as a self-inflicted injury. Well, because it is, right?
Unless you fucked a German.
Well, that becomes a problem later. But no fraternisation in 1945, and they give up on that quite quickly. But it's a self-inflicted injury. So you wouldn't turn yourself in.
No.
So the VD rates, and there's all these numbers in the book. The VD rates are the men reporting how ill they are if they're sick.
Yeah.
There's obviously there's a whole load of people who just thought I'll style it out. I'll tell them I've got tonsillitis. You know, get the antibiotics that way.
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, this book. I mean, it's not a light-hearted bit by any means, but you're funny. You are funny around the subject as well as it being quite a serious subject. But it's very impressive because it is like a proper history book, and it must be nice to, you know, and it's been accepted, I think, by historians.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it must
very,
be. It must be nice. Because you've done a lot of work. You know, I think even within your stand-up, when you do something like How Britain's All Won Every War. There's a lot of scholarship in that routine.
Yeah, that's
more
like pub quiz scholarship.
Well, a little
but
bit.
That, no, but I was very nervous about this book because I did entirely expect to be told to stay in my lane and all that. You're not allowed to be interested in more than one thing. If you've done one thing in public, you're supposed to stick to it, aren't you? And this is very much I mean, I was able to write this because of the pandemic. If I'd been on my normal timetable, it would have taken like much, much longer to put together and to find the time to find the stuff to base the book on.
Yeah. How are you finding I did, you know, I'm fucked. I did a gig in Leicester yesterday and drove myself.
Yeah.
But it's only 2 hours each way.
Yeah.
I'm absolutely fucked today.
Yeah.
How, and it's because I'm 50, I mean, it's partly having young
You're older
kids,
than me, right?
I'm a little bit old. Am I a little bit? I'm a year old.
55, right?
Yeah.
50. Yeah, that's it.
I mean, it's the one
that's
more
the
year.
Problem, yeah.
I remember reading about, I can't remember who it was, but some old school comedian was about 55 and said, I'm giving up because the driving's too much. And now I'm there and I'm kind of thinking, I'd quite like to go back on tour, but, you know, if I get this tired after one gig...
Yeah, but I mean, I have a guy...
You have a guy driving you?
He drives, yeah.
I wouldn't do it if I go on tour.
And he's even older than me.
Is he?
Yeah.
I still think even
he's
if you're
60.
It's still quite exhausting being driven by, you know, like the travelling is hard, right?
But you've learned to just sleep, haven't you?
I can't, I'm not very good at sleeping.
I'm quite good at that, yeah.
A little. I mean, I get better because I'm so tired.
I mean, not
tired.
While you're driving.
Not when I'm driving. But I do sleep a bit in cars now because I'm so tired, but I usually find it quite difficult. Are you finding okay the touring experience?
Yeah, the touring was all right, but the big change is I was at home for the longest I've ever been at home.
Yeah.
For the pandemic, right? And it has met, you know, I always think people who use the expression work-life balance are fucking wankers, right? They need, you know, shut up, right? It's all life, right? But I've what we did the first half of the year, and it really worked very well, was we did two or three a week, right?
Yeah.
And no longer. And then there was a bit in the middle of the year and then at the end of the year where I was away 4 or 5 days. And I used to just, who cares? I used to be like, I'd not give a shit about that.
Yeah.
Like, just shrug it off. Brilliant, Manchester tomorrow, we'll go for lunch there. Like, all that, right? And I found it, in the autumn, it really actually started to sort of get me down because I'd been at home so much.
Yeah, well, I feel the same as well, yeah.
And I don't know, maybe next year, if and when I go out next year, that will have worn off. But maybe not. It may be. But it also, I also think it's also possibly a function. You know, I'm not young anymore. Like, you know what I mean? If I were 35, I'd like, yeah, sure, I'd bash through it all. But you get a bit older and you get a bit more tired and your knee gets hot for no reason going upstairs.
Was the lockdown particularly hard? I mean, you know, I think like you and I both, I feel it a lot less now, but, you know, my wife would notice if I hadn't gigged for a bit, like before lockdown, that I'd get a bit antsy, and she'd always say, the minute I went out and did a gig, I was much nicer.
Right at the start, I was about to go on tour, and I think Steve's here, who's our agent, so we could talk about this. Can I, Steve? Great. So so we were about to go out, and we'd had a problem at Watford Coliseum where their roof had fallen in the previous autumn.
Okay. Right?
So we'd had to postpone the gig. So we postponed it to, like, March.
Right.
And we couldn't get a straight answer out of them whether the roof was still falling in or not and all that. And the pandemic was, like, obviously coming. And the amazing thing about that is we had some gigs booked in the Far East and the promoters go, don't worry about it, it'll be fine. you can still come out to Thailand, don't worry, it'll be all right. Hong Kong, yeah, no problem, right? Really, okay. In April, you know, like after this little run of gigs. Anyway, we couldn't get a straight answer out of Watford Coliseum, so it was all this like, we're going to have to make a decision, what do we do? And I was secretly thinking, God, it'd be brilliant not to have to go out.
Yeah.
It'd be brilliant, be at home for a bit. So when it first started, I basically said to myself, it's all right. You've had a good run. Things have gone well. There's still some people who like you. You get to pick and choose a bit, and you don't need the laughter anymore. You don't need the approval of strangers. You're not like you were when you started.
Yeah.
You're a whole person. You're complete. Right? It's okay. Right? You're like the laugh. The laughter's nice, but it's no longer what fuels you. And then in that first summer, when they started allowing gigs in pub gardens, Math Brown rang me and said, oh, I'm doing a thing down in Hampton Wick or something. Pub garden, you know, it's 100 people at tables. Do you want to do it? And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I'm kind of okay. I don't really need the laughter. And he said, oh, fuck's sake, come down. I said, but I haven't got any stuff. He said, oh, don't worry. You don't need to worry about it. You'll be all right. So I go down and we're all up in the room where the club normally is. And we came down the fire escape and onto the, you know, and everyone on those trestle tables and all that. And I did about 40 minutes and I was as high as a kite. Right after the people laughing, And I realised I'd just been like lying to myself. Like it's a craven attempt to rationalise everything. And then I'm straight away, you got another one, you know. And then I really got into doing stuff on Zoom, like figured out a way to do it. James Gill's club, Always Be Comedy, we did a pub quiz every Monday night, and I'd sit in my office and he'd prepare it all, and then we'd do it, and we'd have got 120 people, and I'd have 40 people, regular people with their kitchens and their living rooms and their, you know, lounges and all that, and it was brilliant.
Yeah.
And it actually meant I was all right.
Yeah.
Because in the end, you know, I don't like the idea that we're all like suicidal comedians, but I think we're as representative a cross section of people as any other.
Yeah.
But we do all really like it when people laugh at our jokes.
There's something missing in the heart.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think also you're similar to me in that I think you in real life you describe yourself as quite conformist, and as a child you were very conformist,
very much
rule
so.
Obeying, which I was.
Yeah.
I was very scared of doing anything naughty or wrong, and yet on stage. And you have a whole armour of the persona around you. I mean, the character around you. And mine's a bit more like me, but still a sort of extended version of myself. We can be much.
But I remember seeing a comedian in like 1988, I think, who was trading under the name Cecil Massey.
Oh yes, I did do a character.
Rich did this character. He was an old man. Which was quite a thing to try and pull off when you were 21. Like, I'm all really old. Like. And you used to say all sorts of like, and it was, and you could see that I could see how liberating it was.
Yeah.
That, and also that what you're openly saying is we're here to play together. We're here to play, and you know, in a weird way, this is a safe space where we can say terrible things, and we know we don't mean them.
Yeah.
We have agreed that we don't mean any of this, and that is sort of, I mean, you know, this is the endless argument about doing a character and where does the truth truly lie and all that shit that I get thrown at me. But yeah, I mean, I was a very, very conformist child, and there's still a big streak of me that wants, I feel like that's the sort of magnetic north I'm always being pulled back to.
Yeah.
And that I really need to resist. It's a peculiar mindset, and it's you know, I think maybe in all the comedy I've done, that sort of push and pull is where the energy for it has come from.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, because in the end, we're starting to dissect the frog here, but which is quite tricky.
Well, you never want to look at why things work and why things don't. Like with this podcast. I kind of every now and again think, am I doing it right? Do I need to go back and think about how I used to do it? And then I think, no, I'm just whatever it is, I'll do whatever it is and see how it goes. You know, is it changing? Is it changing the wrong way? Is the right way? And the minute you start doing that, you'll fuck yourself
up. Oh, no, you're really in trouble.
You've just got to go, okay, I trust my instincts.
Yeah.
And if it is different than it was 10 years ago, which fucking hell I hope it is.
Well, exactly. Exactly. You know, when people say, how has the pub landlord changed? Well, I mean, I was 30 years younger when I started doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's changed enormously. Well, I think the sort of the thing in the middle of the you know is the same.
Yeah.
Well, the aim is the same, but of course I have to change it too, or I'll go mad.
Yes.
I mean, it's the other big part of it. So you'll
I
go,
mean, the
you'll
other
go
option is to not do him anymore. But is that an option for you?
No, because if I were to do me as stand up, I literally wouldn't know where to start. Because after all of the conventions of stand up are that you're not telling the truth, that you've compressed stories, you've exaggerated them. I mean, I'll see stand ups, put someone special on, and I'll be talking about my brother said this, my mum did that, and you think, fucking hell, you know, make some stuff up. I've created a whole world and a mindset, you lazy bastard. You're literally going around to your mum's house hoping she says something stupid. Or, you know, going to a tourist attraction in the hope that it's shit. Yeah. You know, so you can get squeezed 5 minutes out of the lemon, right? And think, well, I've invented an explanation of how the City of London works, you lazy pricks. I remember, and, you know, Chris Ramsey's a really good friend of mine because I worked with him, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And he's a brilliant, he's a lovely, lovely bloke. But I remember him ringing me up and going, you won't believe what's fucking happened. And he'd been arrested in a hotel in a case of mistaken identity. And you think, well, there's your show. you lucky fucker. nothing happens to me. So I can't, you know. And I also, I would rather make stuff up.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. that's my inclination, and I think and stand up also, because of those conventions, offers you that opportunity anyway.
Mm.
Why not make stuff up?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting.
And it doesn't have to be about yourself.
And you never did you? So the other act you did was the murder.
Yeah, yeah.
The noises, which was a sort of character, just yeah. Well, and a sort of special act.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Well.
Basically, yeah.
But yeah, that's interesting. You never, I mean, you did sketches.
And... The thing is, because I mean, I think it's an interesting way to live where you talk about your life all the time.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting way to live because you know, if you sit your parents down and say, I'm going to do that joke about the time at Sunday lunch, Mum asked me what anal sex was,
yeah. Right?
And your parents go, what? Did that happen? Or did you make that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't have to bother with any of that. My mother has to come and see a show where I mean, when they came to a show where I used the C word 35 times. My dad sort of came and said he'd enjoyed it. Anyway. But you know what I mean? I think one of the big mistakes people make about stand-up is they're prescriptive about what it ought to contain.
Yeah.
And the brilliant thing about it is it is a blank page. It's a blank stage. It's a blank page. Put what you want on it. You don't have to talk about yourself. You don't have to tell the truth. The truth isn't important on stage. Truth is,
but not the truth. Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean?
I do. No, yeah.
And I think that can get lost sight of when you know, because what you get in the kind of critical establishment is sort of phases of ideas of what comedy ought to be and what it ought to contain. And I kind of think, yeah, fine. Right, it's got to be funny though, right? It's sort of boring. My boring starting point. You know, any prescriptive description of what it ought to be will probably fail.
Yes, is you know it should be entertaining. One would hope.
But then entertainment is all sorts of things as well. So you know that's the other thing. It yeah. doesn't have to serve a purpose apart from entertaining. But and you know blah 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 blah.
But you I go mean, through different phases as a comedian yourself. Yeah. And thinking one, you know, and I've certainly been through that thing. I'll do something experimental. I'll do something deliberately boring. I'll do something deliberately annoying. And then if you come to, yeah, I think I've got to try and do something that people will go home happy. So it's you know it's a fascinating thing. There's so much stuff to this job, and like yeah. you say, so many different ways of doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes you think, can I tell an hour-long story? Or shall I do an almighty callback from the start rather than, you know, how do I thread this together?
Yeah.
What clumps do I put it in? Do I start with something really, like, easy, or do I start with something where they go, well, you know, like, what do I do? How do I do this? And that you've got all those things to consider as well.
Yeah.
But I just think the minute you're prescriptive about it, you're in real trouble.
So you're going to carry on doing the land
of course I am, yeah.
Yeah.
Can't do anything else.
Well, we're going to have to wrap it up because we've run out of time. There's something, and we'll have to come back for an eighth appearance.
Who's done the most?
I think Buxton's done eight.
All right, fair enough.
I think Buxton's done eight, but, you know, that's, again, including book clubs in Edinburgh yeah. and stuff. But you've got a lot because you did. I think you did all...
Yeah, I mean, I got in it when you couldn't make any phone calls, basically, yeah. just to resort to the people you knew.
Just had to get to whoever I knew to go with somebody that's, you know, hasn't changed that much. I was going to ask you how you thought Russia were doing against Ukraine, but I don't think we got time. So, how their tanks are going.
Well. Oh well, no, that's a. I mean,
it's too long.
It's too long. It's about history too.
Yeah,
because one of the problems they had in the Soviet Union is they never were honest about how they fought the Second World War, and that stuff has been so encased and crystallized into what was then Red Army doctrine after the Second World War during the Cold War, and then what's seeped into what. So, they haven't basically don't know why they won.
Right.
So they don't know how to win.
Yeah.
And they since then, everyone else's thinking has moved on. Is what it comes down to. Yeah. But I could get really boring about that quite quickly, as I've just demonstrated.
Let's not do that.
You feel the temperature drop in the room there.
just one word answer. Are we going to get dragged into a World War III?
Eventually.
Yeah, great. Okay, good. There we are. That's the big news from the historian.
It's already started.
It has already started. Yeah. It's all just the world in one place, the whole world involved in one country at the moment. But we'll see if we can get it out everywhere, spread it around a bit. It's been... We'll always dream. We can sit at home. I know it'll be everywhere. It's a World War shit.
I think we'd end up being sort of ain't half hot mum.
They're going
to send
us
out. Should conscription come in? you and me in a concert party.
Wow. I don't want to do this podcast in front of a load of squaddies. And that's all I can say. Ladies and gentlemen, give it up. The amazing Al Murray!
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahulastapur with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Al Murray. Thank you to Scant Regard for providing the music. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. Also to Chris Evans, not that one, and all of his crazy crew. And great to be back at the Leicester Square Theatre after two horrible weeks in Leicester. This is the Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.